Right. Welcome, everyone. So this is our second Module 5 call, and we'll be talking more about coaching with our clients' self-doubt stories today. Excuse me. And then we're going to take a short two-week break for summer holidays. I know some of you may be wrangling small people, trying to entertain them for a number of weeks. So the idea is that we'll have a break. You can kind of integrate. The other thing just to also mention to folks is that you'll find in your email last week about this module a guide for setting up a single session offer. Hopefully everyone has at least received that. If you haven't had a chance to look at it, then there's no dramas there at all. But what I would offer is that this could be a really great opportunity to start playing with this work and get some return on your investment, right? In your time and in your skill and all of that jazz. Read the guide, see what you think. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to get in touch. Or if it's just us here. If you want someone to read over a offer or anything like that, I'm super happy to do that. And I would also say, if that idea appeals to you, if you're kind of thinking, yeah, I would kind of like to see how this rocks out with my clients or my potential clients, don't wait too long. What I found is that we can kind of get ourselves into some protective beliefs about being a student, right? I need to get to the end of this whole process before I can, you know, offer support. And this is one of the reasons that I only work with folks who've already got some fundamental coaching skills or have been working in a kind of service role one-to-one with people. They've got that experience. And that's because you don't need to work. You don't need to wait, right? You've probably all got that that experience and maybe even have some clients that you're working with already. I know most of you have. So yeah, great. Cassie, that's brilliant. Yeah. Just working on a post to offer single sessions. Fab. Yeah. And, what I'd also offer is a great way to do this. And this may be a little activating, but don't hesitate in like emailing your network and asking them to refer people to you. Honestly, that is how I set my practice up. It's how I recommend every coach that's starting sets their practice up. Make a big list of everyone you know, let them into your life, be a bit vulnerable. You're just sending an email. What I have found is that the folks that are interested in this work are super happy to refer people, or they want to ask more questions. It's a lovely opportunity to catch up with people you may have not seen for a while. So don't hesitate, and don't wait. And I love that you said this, Jane. You're going to offer some free sessions just to get practice. Don't do that. Even if it's a token amount, you are further along the path than your potential client. You're going to get they're going to get a ton of value from this. And yes, the exchange is for sure you'll get some practice, but you this work is valuable. I really want people to value this work as much as I know our clients do. So when we can own that, it's like brilliant. So yeah, please. Yeah, I love that. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, realistic price rather than offer low cost sessions. Well, don't offer low cost sessions. Charge for it. So I've been charging. My prices, to be totally transparent, for one-off 90-minute sessions with a half-hour follow-up a month later is £299. So what I recommend to coaches who are starting out is start with £100 an hour or $100 an hour, just because it's clean and easy to then do the math. When you're working with 20 clients at £100 an hour, that's what 100K looks like. So, you know, do the math. Do what feels good. Check in with your body, check in with what feels appropriate for you. But also, you know, you don't know how much folks are willing to pay. We don't want to get entangled with their money situation. So you sit with what feels good to you. But I just wanted to say, you know, if this feels good to you, you'll never know how much people are willing to pay for this until you say, this is what I feel cleanly is of value, and this is what I want to charge for it, and you see where you get to. But I found £100 an hour is a pretty good indicator. I would say when I started with my first clients, when I was a student, a coaching student, I was charging, I think, £25 an hour. And I still have kept the PayPal receipt of my very first paid session. And I remembered like bursting into tears afterwards and thinking, I can't believe someone paid me to do something and it was that much fun. It was just the best feeling. So, you know, you've got to sit with what feels good to you. But I'm just giving you a sense of the value of this work is, you know, around that price point. You guys get to obviously sit with what feels good to you. Okay. Right. Let's start talking a bit more about our client self-doubt stories. Today we're going to really shift. Last week we talked about the belief buster and we talked about slowing down and building awareness around where our client stories sit. So I'm just going to share my screen so you can see what we're talking about today. So today we're just going to revisit those aims that we started talking about last time, and this idea of the client's thin stories. And we're going to go into how to get our clients experimenting with new, helpful, healthy beliefs, right? And I've got some suggestions for what you can take to your practice pods and preparing for our break and that kind of thing, okay? Right. So remember, the whole aim of playing with our clients' stories is that the earlier we can get our clients to start interrupting their stories before their alarm goes off, right, before that they start holding back, the quicker they can leave the loop, right, the quicker they get out of that place of, oh, this is too much, I can't do it, and they stop, right? So we start telling ourselves a story and then we hold back. Check the chat and see if you notice any stories about offering one-off sessions of deep value, right? Like, it's all the time. We're only human. This happens for us too. But notice that you can tell yourself a different story and see what that offers you in terms of what actions you can take, what feelings you can access, right? And we've got this toolkit that we're playing with around our client stories, the meaning making map around looking at the client's past experiences and expanding out what could be possible. So taking that often quite emotive and difficult experience where we decided what was true and then never kind of questioned it. We're giving our clients the opportunity to look at those experiences from the past and thicken the narrative, right? Expand out what else could have been going on that they may not have been aware of at the time, but that they can access from a slightly wiser, older self, from a place that's not stuck in that emotion, from a place where they are feeling that rested, resourced, and regulated spot, yeah? So the belief buster is about the present story, right? What's happening in the moment. We went through that process last week. And again, that is still worth coming back to again and again and again, right? It's one of those tools that our clients like to learn because it's helping them to do that thing where they can actually question their own stories and question their own thinking and see where they get to. And experiments are what we're going to sort of take the belief buster, the second part of the belief buster, and into experiments today. when our clients start experimenting, they're testing the validity of their new belief, right? They're testing the validity of that more helpful belief. Can I take action from here? Am I able to build a new story so that when I'm taking action in the future, when I'm faced with a task that brings up some risk for me, I have a new story I can tell myself and I have some new evidence about what's true. So it's because often our stories around our self-doubt are outdated. We've inherited them from other people and never questioned them. We haven't sat with, well, what's true for me now? Right? And Jane, you're giving a great example of this, right? The story of, well, no one will pay this for coaching. And I've got evidence from my past teacher who says this, right? So it's like, that's all great, right? So now you've got you've got differing information, right? You've got me saying, well, you can charge. You can absolutely charge. This work is valuable. You are a practitioner. We wouldn't get our dentist to practice on us for free, right? We'd expect to pay because they've reached a certain standard of care and skill. So when we value this work, it makes it easier for our clients to value it. And we're staying disentangled from their ability to pay, right? We get clear about that for ourselves so that we can pay. And so you've got, so they can pay. So you've got some conflicting advice here. And of course, you know, your healthy adult self will know what's good for you. And there'll probably be some self-doubt mixed in there as well, right? But the idea is when you're experimenting, you can see what feels good, right? You can see what is true. At the moment, we've got a belief, my network will not pay this amount or there is a cap, right? And we don't really know that. It's an assumption, right? We can't know what anyone else will value. But we can make an educated guess and we can play with that and see what feels good for us. That's called an experiment. Yeah. So how do we help our clients make that move? What we're trying to do here, remember, is thicken the narrative, right? Self-doubt stories tend to be thin. They tend to be quite simple and quite absolute, right? Usually they're based on how we feel in the moment. They tend to be based on all or nothing thinking. We globalize. This is true for everyone. No one will do this. I always that, right? And usually they're based on what feels safe to us, what feels safest to us, what requires the least from us, the least courage from us. So when we start thickening those stories, we introduce some nuance and some complexity and some possibility. We start to see, oh, that's not always true. Okay, what else is possible for me? What else is possible for my clients? Yeah. So I just want to check in and see, have you played with the belief buster? Have you had an opportunity to kind of do this for yourself? What's been your experience? If you have anything you want to just share about this process, how that's landing for you, what you're thinking and feeling about it all. Let's open it up. Then we're going to get into your client's experience. Anyone want to share anything? Just unmute yourself.
Hi everyone. Yeah, I think the belief buster is magical. Absolutely magical. I love the way it just flips thinking, reframes thinking in, you know, if you say to somebody, let me help you reframe your thinking, they'd go, no, no. But there's something about the order of the questions. It just happens. And and I've had a go just writing it out for myself for various issues. And I just find it gives me so much more space to maneuver, you know, in terms of my attitude, approach, thoughts around something. So even there, Sass, hearing you talk about thickening the story, I'm like, yeah, well, what about sliding scales? And then, you know, then those who can't can sign up at a very low cost, and those who can choose. And then I can see if anybody does choose the full price. And it's just an experiment. If everybody goes for the really low cost option based on who they, how they think of themselves, then. So, yeah, I think really good. I had a go at the experiments and I found that harder. And Anchor and I were talking about that in the practice pod the other day. And we did some, we did the belief bus coaching in the practice pod as well. So I don't know, Anchor, if you want to share anything about that.
Yeah, so I was the beneficiary of Jane's awesome belief buster coaching, and it was really amazing. We were both like surprised. Like, I mean, I had used it the day before with my husband, who's a counselor, who has a client who is like at the edge of the autism spectrum plus personality disorder. And my husband had no experience with that. So I helped him with his kind of self-doubt just using the belief buster, and his mind was blown. And he had an awesome session with that client, while Jane had an awesome session with me with the same technique. So it was just like, I was mind blown. My husband was mind blown. Jane and me were mind blown. So it was kind of like, people are like, Sass, it's magic.
It's so cool. So secret kind of, well, not secret. Let me just be totally transparent. One of the reasons I say, like, let's talk about how people are using this, is that this is what happens, is you start to see, oh, hang on a freaking minute. This story that I'm telling myself, I can, exactly what Jane says, I can make some room for some more creativity to come in. And look, you haven't even gone through the belief buster and you've already gone, oh, hang on, sliding scale. That could be my answer here, right? And I think that is what starts to happen, is you make room for your healthy adult self to come in and offer you some more creative solutions, more creative, healthier, helpful beliefs. I always feel like they're always just around the corner. They're kind of sitting on the client's shoulder, just waiting for them to go, oh, hang on, there's this guy. I could play with this guy, right? So I love that you're sharing this. And notice how valuable that is, right? The ripple effect of Anki, you sharing this with your husband, and him then being able to have a different presence with his client. Like, this for me is catnip, right? It's absolutely the case. And you know, I can't take a massive amount of credit for this, although I've finessed this process, but it is rooted in rational emotional behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. Will use similar kinds of things. I think because I'm always really mindful of not activating the protector, right, of staying in that trauma-informed place of, we have no idea what the client's bringing to this, and always wanting to keep them in that resource-regulated state, that the language around it, for me, it has made the difference, right? So that staying in that, what's likely, what's possible, what's desired, is a way of just gently introducing some ideas. So exactly what you say, Jane, people kind of go, reframing or mindset work. It's almost like we're so immune to that now. And I think we're a little bit suspicious of it, because it feels like we're kind of kidding ourselves on some level. But what this is trying to do is say, what else could be true? So I love that you've shared this. And if anything, this is hopefully giving everyone some experience of the value of this, right? If a client that you're working with has been stuck in a place on a belief that feels intractable, and you offer them a way out, and they can do the thing in their life that they have been holding back from because of that, that's hugely value to someone. And because it comes easier to us, because we have this skill and knowledge and experience and all the work you do to maintain that lovingly detached presence with your client, that's the exchange. That's the value exchange. Yeah. Yeah, Anke.
I just like to add this because I was like, how am I talking to my husband who's a counselor? He's like experienced in this stuff. He was a supervisor. He managed 50 people. Like, who am I to help him with this kind of thing? And actually the only thing why he wanted to try it is that I explained these other two things, like the three selves. And then also that, that we can't basically work from protector to protector or from triggered self to triggered self or whatever. And he was like, oh my God, what self is doing this? Awesome. Can you help me with that? Because he has all this kind of complicated multidimensional DSM diagnosed weirdness in his mind and didn't know how, when he was triggered himself, he was like, so activated that he thought he has to fix something. And I, you know, just based on your simple theory that gives us like tiny little baby coaches the idea, oh, we can play with three things, but not with 10. Yeah. That made him trust. And that made him also think like, okay, maybe a coach teacher can help a big, you know, psychologist. Yeah. And I found this so beautiful again for how you have broken down the complex method from therapy training for us to really be able to have them in mind while we are in a situation and have to hold so many horses, you know, to drive because there's always a lot going on.
Yeah.
So it's like, for me, it was like I was so grateful for the work you have done to prepare us to be able to do this kind of complex work and give us a recipe. Like if I don't know how to cook, I take a recipe and then at the end, somebody says, oh, the pizza was good, you know? So here, like Jane and I, like Jane could just go with the two, you know, these two worksheets.
Yeah.
And also like Scott, like the third in our pod, sometimes said to Jane, you asked these awesome questions. Jane was like, haha, this was just from the worksheet, you know? So you gave us already even questions to answer so that we can trust the process and our own self-doubt doesn't need to bring our protector up. But we can just trust your self-belief and say, oh, Sass has put this question there. Let me ask it. And then I can feel good about doing the work. So, yeah, thank you very much.
You're so, so welcome. Oh, Anka, that's really lovely to hear. And I'm so glad you had that experience. I think one of the real gifts I've had is being able to work with a real variety of clients over the years, including a lot of people with, you know, two PhDs and a wanky great, you know, job title. And what I found is they have self-doubt. And sometimes they are in that place of overproving themselves often. The super successful folks who, and I have so much empathy for that because I've overworked my whole life, right? Then that was a way of trying to alleviate my own self-doubt. It's like I want some relief from that feeling of somehow I'm not good enough. The way it shows up for me was to overwork. And so I found the folks that tend to get into, you know, big leadership roles, their protector is very familiar to me. And if you have that too, like that kind of conductor type energy around your own self-doubt, it's a huge gift to be able to work with people who maybe have some quite big energy, and to be able to see that you can create some safety and trust for them, and they will let you see their vulnerable, soft, squishy centers, and that's amazing to see. And, you know, never forget everyone who is a counselor, a psychologist, you know, a doctor of whatever, or, you know, even, you know, Sir What's-His-Face, right? They've all grown up in a world that wanted them to be smaller than they actually are, smaller than their spirits often. We're all socialized to, you know, follow the script that the world wants us to follow. And so I always just come back to, you know, what's going on for you? Where are you at? I don't, like you said, Anka, with your client who was the architect, right? Who was this big fancy architect running a massive world, global practice. They came to you because you can see through that to the essence of the person. When I look at people now, I often see someone who is, you know, like usually trying to manage their protector as much as they can. And we see a lot of grown-ups who are actually kids in adult clothes. You know, you just have to look at the British cabinet to see that. You've got, honestly, we have a cabinet full of little boys who were separated from their families at a very young age and told to cope. Do not show weakness. And this is the result of that, you know. So it's kind of like, this should be no surprise. So all to say, whoever you are using this approach with, however you do it, if you follow the script or ad lib and make it your own, the idea is this has real value for people. No matter what their job title is.
Can I just share
something
else, which I think might be connected? When we worked through the Belief Buster, it was extraordinary when I asked Anka how she would like to feel. How would you like to feel starting this, you know, in this context? And it came really easily. She said how she wanted to feel. And then I could see her whole body change. And then ideas flowed. And the other half of the page was really easy. But I just really noticed how much, when you said, how would you like to feel? And her whole body softened and opened and thoughts flowed. And then last night I was walking a dog and sometimes it's a chore, especially at night round the streets for his final walk. But last night I was walking the dog and I remember I kind of looked up and thought, oh, what a lovely evening. What a nice sky. What a nice time of night to be out. And I felt my body soften. And then I started thinking about coaching. I started doing a bit of dreaming, which is something I don't find easy. I think my protector stops me from dreaming about what might be possible. But I just found myself kind of gently daydreaming about what it might be like to see clients on a regular basis and do the work. And then I noticed that I was really upright. I was really, my shoulders were back and my whole body language as I walked was really different. I wasn't looking down, I wasn't stooped. I just felt really different in my body. Anyway, I don't know what I'm saying, but I think there's something about that point where you say, how would you like to feel? And people step into it. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think as well, what you're describing is that's a regulated state. When your nervous system is calm and you're able to access an emotion that you want to feel, there's something about your body that goes, oh, yeah, this would be great to feel. And there is a release of some sort. That somatic intelligence of our body saying, yeah, look how good this feels. What's possible from here?
Yeah.
And there is a really, I think, quite a beautiful process that happens in that mind-body connection. There's no real separation, I don't think. But when we consciously bring those things together, you start to see, oh, I can consciously create this. And yeah, and I love that you noticed, oh, I'm standing upright and I feel different in my body, you know? Yeah. I think
before I start charging clients, I need to do a somatic training. And then I might be ready.
I think you're already doing it. And that's a nice story. Beautiful. Love it. Okay, cool. So what I want us to talk about today, this is fabulous. What I want us to talk about today is how we do that thing that Jane said was a bit harder actually, to then take this healthy belief into practice, into an experiment where you're trying some stuff out. This is where the courage comes from, right? A question I used to get asked all the time, how can I just feel confident? For me, there's some steps to that. Right, we've got to have some clarity over what we want to feel some confidence around, And then we've got to have some courage to try some stuff out. Once we get more competent at those things, you find that the confidence comes as a result, right? But it actually takes a little bit of courage to try that. So what I want you to get really obsessed about is what are the thin stories that your clients will tell you. And the reason for this is that as you get to know who your clients are and the kinds of folks you like working with, you get to know more about the ones that you may get entangled with, right? Because you're like, oh, yeah, I wouldn't pay that for coaching either. So shit, now where do we go, right? Because then I'm coaching your protector from my protector. No healthy coaching is happening, right? So it's a really good idea to just get familiar with what are two things. What are your clients' thin stories? What do you start hearing over and over again? What are the assumptions you make about your clients' thin stories? So you can take some really good educated guesses around your particular client group. And then what are the ones you share with them? What are the ones you both have? So I want to share this with you, and we're going to take just 5 minutes to sort of do a little bit of a reflection. Just start to think about, what are your clients' beliefs? What are their emotions? What do they do or not do or say or don't say? Just make some assumptions. If you think about the kinds of folks that you tend to work with, what comes up? I'm just going to take a few minutes. I want you to get some ideas down on paper. I'll just take another couple of minutes. Just any kind of brainstorming ideas you have, just jot them all down. Just take a look at what you've written down. And folks, if you're watching the replay, I'm hoping you're still with us. 5 minutes is a great start point for this, right? Because the idea is we'll put this stuff off and make a big old deal about it. But I just want you to see how much you already know. 5 minutes of jotting down some bullet points. And I imagine you've all got quite a good idea of the protective beliefs that your clients are probably experiencing. I highly recommend particularly if you like to be a bit creative with your kind of thinking and idea formulation. I used to have 4 pieces of A3 with these titles and up on my office wall, and I would just keep adding to them. And over a period of time, it built an incredibly helpful picture of who my clients were. Lots of stuff came from that because I was able to really get a sense of what's going on underneath, you know, and what assumptions can I make? What can I play with? It's actually, if any of you have done any research, this is a part of grounded theory research. As you start getting feedback from your clients, and then the theory comes from the ground up, right? So you start with what you already know, and then you just build in. So keep adding to this. You're going to get a really good grip on who your clients are and what holds them back. What I want you to notice is, are there beliefs in there that you share with them? There's a few smiles. That is inevitable. Inevitable, because we often are, you know, attracted to working with folks that we feel an affinity to. Part of that is going to be shared beliefs, good, bad, and indifferent, right? So it's just good to know that, right? It's good to know that where you feel stuck, if your clients are bringing that up, that's where, you know, you're going to need to seek out supervision support or something to assist you to kind of move through that. So I just want to really normalize that. Like we will slip into our own sort of survivor self. We'll get into our protectors when we feel like, oh, I don't know what to say because I'm as stuck as you. I'm now in the hole with you and I don't know what to do either. It feels like your protective belief is utterly legitimate and there's no way out. Yes, Jane.
I remember in one of the earlier sessions, Saz, you said something like, you will attract clients like you, or you will attract clients with the same issues as you, because that happens. Why does that happen?
Well, it's like we find safety in people like us, right? And our clients do too. they usually see something in us that reminds them of the way we talk about our work, the way we talk about them. There will be something, it's a kind of mystery, I think, in some ways. Like it's an attraction thing. But I think it does come down to who do we trust? How do we know someone is our people or is safe for us? And I think our clients are going to feel like that. There's something about that coach in particular, you as a coach in particular, where they think, oh, you get me. Sometimes that's about a shared experience, i.e., you know, if it's, you know, like in Cassie's work, it's potentially about, you know, you're going to have clients where you've worked in the same environments, you get what that's like, you've lived the whole Bear series, right? The Bear, the restaurant series. I love it so much. But man, it's stressful. So you get that experience that they are living through, and you get it from a different perspective because you are also a woman and you are working with women in leadership roles in that industry. So there is a sense of, oh, you're safe. You know, there's something about your experience. You get me. But it's also the words you use to describe your work every time you have contact with people who could potentially be a client. There'll be something about where you're at that feels safe to them. Yeah. And I think that's a beautiful thing, right? That's a great thing because it means you're going to have that sense of, oh, we just clicked. It was great. Like there was a sense of inevitability, a real, I see you, you see me. This is a great thing. And so sometimes I think it can be a bit of a fright when something goes wrong in the coaching context. Either there's a misunderstanding or perhaps even a conflict, or the client responds to something in an unexpected way. We feel like we're not really helping them and something happens. They present us with a protective belief we share, and we feel like, I can't help you. I don't know where to go with this. I'm stuck with this. And so that's inevitable and also a great opportunity for us to kind of learn, right? To go, oh, good to know. When that happens, I tend to respond in this way. Sometimes I found clients there would be that sort of sense of, this is my person, right? We get each other. And then fourth session in, I'm like, oh my God, she reminds me of someone that I really don't like. And it's just like a tone of voice thing. And it's something in me goes, oh, unsafe. And I can't quite quantify that with logic. It's more of a somatic response. And so then my work is, you know, how do I separate my client from this person that I've had a real difficult conflict with? How do I, reassure myself this person is safe? It's my job to hold space for this person. So I've got to take care of my own stuff so I can do that in a really effective way. Yeah. Yeah, Anke.
Like that's kind of what Jane coached me about in the part situation. And my feeling is I think it's very helpful, Jane, that you also say we will attract these people, because one thing that's holding me back from doing coaching as my main job is that I'm afraid of meeting people I can't coach. And if it's too many, I would just totally fall in like stop all the stuff with the coaching. Yeah. And the one thing that I really feel, especially also after the session with Jane now and everything we are learning here, is that and you say this as too, that we will get these people. And I think also we will get them because it's like, for me, it's my blind spot. And there is so much more to know about clients than I already can know. There will be people where I am learning with them. And the question is just, what do I need in order to do this learning? And I feel like we are getting here the information, especially like the flip from the protective belief to the, how do I want to feel? Like if I'm like, what I would try to do now, if I'm in a situation like where I get like, oh no, I don't know, I'm afraid, you know, whatever. I'm like, okay, how do I want to feel? And then, okay, like if I would like to feel that, then I have again access to more of something I can think And then I can come out of it. And later after the session, I can get some support and then go back in with this support and not just with myself and my limitation. So it's kind of, I think there's a process we are getting here, like tools for that we can actually use if we have difficult people. And now I'm kind of a little bit curious to get more of them because I want to try it out. Yes.
Well, that was my fear too, right? Going into coaching, I was like, oh, what if I get really annoying people? Right? What if I get people I don't like? What if I get people I don't care what happens to them? Because I was pretty sarcastic and judgy in my corporate world. That was my protective defenses. And what I found was that it didn't take very long for me to start leading with my soft and squishy center. And that was almost more terrifying because it's like, oh my God, now I'm going to care too much. So yeah, absolutely. And I love that you've said this idea that we tell ourselves these protective stories. If this happens, I won't cope, right? If I get too many clients where I feel like I can't help them, I won't cope. That hasn't happened yet, by the way, right? It's just an assumption, and it's a protective belief that holds us back from even getting out there and seeing if that's true, right? But I love that what you said, and you may want to listen back to the recording, Anke, is, oh, well, if that happens, I can support myself in the moment by thinking about, okay, how do I want to feel with this client? You know, and for me, my preferred way of coaching, of teaching, of anything in this work, supervising, is can I get into a state of loving detachment where I am absolutely rooting for you and I'm totally detached. If you don't get it, if I say something confusing, if I show up imperfectly, if you don't agree with me, it's like, I'm down. Let's, yeah, of course, that's inevitable. So it's that thing of getting more and more comfortable with how you want to show up and knowing that you can seek out support. Supervision has been transformative for me just in knowing that if anything happens, I've got someone in my corner that can help me unpack it and make sense of it. And what happens is even if you have the very same experience 6 weeks later or 6 years later, you are changed as a result of unpacking that and making sense of it. So you're never coming at it the first time again. You're always a bit more resourced. So by the time you meet your 35th client who feels difficult, you're like, oh, you know, and my question now is, am I meeting a difficult client or is this a client in difficulty? And there's something in that for me, you know, like what is it that I'm being activated by, sometimes even triggered by? So just know that your willingness to coach the folks that maybe do feel a little crunchy is your healthy adult self saying it's safe for you to show up, safe for you to do this imperfectly. Our clients will have all kinds of stories going on about them being a good client and how to keep themselves safe in that situation, right? That's inevitable. So just to come back to this process of getting a sense of who your clients are, what are the protective beliefs that they hold and what is that, how does that show up? How would you recognize them? What I'm hoping is that you're starting to see, oh, this actually gives me some really good info for how I can market my work, right? Because you're saying, hey, I see you where you are. See you where you are. When we can get a really good grip on our clients' protective beliefs, what we can also do is help come up with, in advance, some more helpful ones. So you can offer them to people. Something that, and I just want to show you this because in a second, and I'll show you how this translates into an experiment, is the hardest part of the belief buster is finding the helpful belief. Sometimes it will come, the client is like, just, it's on the tip of their tongue, it's on their shoulder, and they just kind of pluck it off and go, oh, what about this one? And you can feel it because it's like, oh yeah, that lands, that's really helpful to me. What's the first doable step with that belief leading, right? Sometimes it can be trickier, and sometimes our clients want to get it right And maybe we share a belief that unless it's right, it won't work, right? So all of this stuff happens. And so the idea is that you start to kind of translate those beliefs, those protective beliefs, into more helpful ones in advance. So you've just got a little bit of a resource there, right? What I found is I tend to like helpful beliefs that are things like I wonder, or I'm learning, or you know, something that activates that desired emotion. You know, I'm learning too. I wonder if it's safe for me too. You know, when we are doing that last step of the belief buster, which is to come up with the first doable step, the idea is that the client can then take action from that belief straight away. Right? It's like there's no resistance to me doing this. I can do this. And you know, I'm a huge fan of saying, could you do that right now? Like, can you email me in half an hour to let me know that you've done that? Right. It's like when the client's really feeling it, they will be totally down with that. Sometimes though, they need the context to play in, right? They need the specific context to actually try and experiment. Excuse me, sneezing. So what I wanted to share with you is how I will do this with a client in the session, right? So to develop an experiment, we do four things, right? We get the protective belief, and we talk about what the client can do differently, why they are doing that, and I'll talk a bit more about why that's important, and then you know why that, you know, the outcome of this, that they're playing with the more helpful belief. Okay, so I just want to give you an example. The client's protective belief says, my ideas are dumb and I'll be judged if I share them, right? This is a client who works in quite a knowledge economy type role and doesn't share ideas at meetings, doesn't participate in stuff, feels like they're disappearing into the wallpaper kind of thing. And this is a definitely a self-doubt belief, right? So we came up with half a dozen actions that he could try to just see what happens, right? The idea is we want to see how does it feel to him before, during, and after he shares his ideas. Right, that's the data we're collecting, and this is where clients will get. This is where I think this can fall down, is that what they want to do is put in place pass/fail criteria. Right, so my ideas are dumb, and I'll be judged if I share them. The experiment in the client's mind is, if my idea gets adopted, then I'll know it was a good one. Right. But actually what we're doing is being detached from the outcome. Because whether or not his idea is adopted has no bearing on whether or not it was a good one. And what we don't want to do is give the power of whether or not the experiment worked to another person or a place or a thing. We want it to stay with the client, right? So I'll just take you through this and then we'll talk a little bit more in the detail. So the client's belief is, my ideas are dumb. I'll be judged if I share them. We've gone through and created a more protective belief, which is, it's safe to share my ideas. Right, that was the one that landed for him. So we talked about some things that he could do just to bring this to life, right? Keeping a notebook of his ideas, sharing his opinions with loved ones, right? So in the safest, most doable step was to tell his partner that he'd had this idea for something to do with their garden, right? And it was quite sweet. And but he was like, oh no, he won't like that. We'll end up in an argument. He likes very different things to me, all of that jazz. But it was like, oh, that is actually a safe place where I can share my ideas. Sharing one idea with a trusted colleague, right? Sharing my thoughts on other people's ideas, right? So notice these are all actions that he can try in the next week or two. They all feel quite doable. There's not a ton of resistance, but there is a sense of, oh, I'm going to need some courage for some of these, you know, whereas others feel like, no, I can totally do that. And the data he's collecting is, how does it feel to him before, during, and after he shares? right? And what he noticed over the course of this experiment of playing with these ideas for a couple of weeks was that his experience changed. And this is the really key part to experiments is your experience changes. And the whole point of this experiment is in order to find out if it's safe to share my ideas. That was the helpful belief. Is this true? Right? What else could be true? It's safe to share my ideas. Like my ideas are dumb and I'll be judged if I share them. And it's safe to share my ideas. They can coexist. He can believe both of those things. And some things that we wanted to find out, you know, do I like my ideas? Can I get to know my own creative process? Like, do my ideas evolve? If I share them with other people, do I feel subsumed by their opinion or does it become collaborative kind of thing? So, and how does it feel before, during and after? Right. They were the things that he wanted to kind of validate this, this new belief. So he was convinced that the only way that he would know if his idea wasn't dumb is if someone else validated it. So we want to bring it back to what's validating for him. What's his experience? Because his idea could be the best thing ever, but because of his colleagues going, I'm jealous of Dave's great idea, they poo-poo it. Does that make it a bad idea? No, right? We can never know this, right? So the idea was to you know, play with this experiment very much from what was Dave's experience? How did it feel before, during, and after? And what he noticed as he started to change his actions and play with this experiment was he found it easier to share thoughts on other people's ideas, and he could see that he could add value to other people's ideas, which meant it felt more collaborative. And then he found he was seeking out other people's opinions on his because that felt good to him. So he kind of had this experience of keeping a notebook of his stuff and his thoughts and his ideas. He waited a really long time to share his garden idea with his partner, but he did share his thoughts on other people's ideas and found that that actually brought him out of his shell. That was the pathway into really understanding how it could feel good to be collaborative and it could feel good to have other people's opinions on his ideas. And he also had the experience of a colleague saying, that is dumb. Actually used the words of his protective belief. And he said it was like the day before our coaching session, and he said he actually used that word, and I was like, what is happening? But he said it was like, oh yeah, I could really see where it was a bit dumb. I hadn't thought of this other thing, right? So his healthy self had kind of been clocking all of this, and that no longer felt risky. Even when he had a dumb idea, it was okay to share it, right? So I just want to share this example because this is what happens over a period of time when there is a context-specific experiment, is that the client's experience of this, given enough data, will change. They have to be willing to play with the belief, and the actions have to be doable enough that they don't have a ton of resistance around them. Yeah. I just want to pause there for a second and just check in with you around this approach. What questions, comments, ideas you might have around this? How might this work for your people? Yeah,
Cass. I'm finding it interesting because I'm just thinking back to like my coach training, and when you get to that sort of action part at the end of the session, that it's all around accountability and what do you need to set yourself up for success and all this kind of stuff. And this feels a lot softer, a lot more open, like, I'm just kind of mulling over how you then kind of bring that in terms of, well, you know, what do you want to learn from doing that action, or the idea of playing and trying different things.
Yeah.
It's not just, I'm going to go and write the report. It's actually like some there's other things going on at the same time that you could kind of experiment with.
Completely. And there's a couple of really good reasons for this. One is accountability doesn't work for a lot of people. It actually isn't a motivator. So if anyone has paid any money towards a personal trainer to keep them accountable, you'll know this, right? It's like, yeah. So accountability doesn't actually work. Having another person that you're accountable to doesn't actually work for a lot of things, for a lot of people. It particularly is not a motivator when you've got internal resistance. If the task feels unsafe, writing the report feels unsafe, or you feel like there's too much resistance to it, you will procrastinate till the last minute and then do a half-assed job. And then that will reinforce your protective belief. Because that kind of approach, keeping people accountable, what do you need to set yourself up for success? All of those things are great questions. I'm not knocking them at all. But when self-doubt's involved, you are up against a protective entity, protective beliefs and behaviors that will be reinforced when they feel resistance. So what we don't want to do is set the client up so that if they don't do these tasks, there's some cost in our relationship. What we want to do is set up the client so that we are both curious to find out what happens when they start playing with us. And if they don't do any of it, right, that's still worthy of us exploring, right? Because all that will tell me is the actions that you were changing to, there was something about that was too big or too much. We need to break it down a little bit further. Maybe you just need 2 weeks of keeping a notebook of your ideas that you've never shared it with anyone, right? Does that feel safe enough to try? Can you just share your ideas with yourself, right, and see what that feels like? So resistance comes up because our protector is setting off an alarm. And so what we want to do is create an experimenting environment where the client feels safe to play. To try some stuff out, see what happens. So yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't know if you found accountability works. I mean, some people love it, but I found the majority of clients, and particularly when there's resistance and that self-protection mechanism in place, it tends to be the opposite happens.
Well, I'm actually just thinking about myself because, you know, I have a tendency for procrastination. And I have a peer coach, and a bit what you guys were talking about earlier in terms of like for like, we're very similar. So there's always, I'm helping her to move forward with something, she's helping me to move forward with something. And and when it comes to that accountability piece, I'm like, well, I've spent my whole working life being accountable to so many other people working in restaurants. For me now, as I think anybody starting off their own business can struggle with the accountability for themselves, because you've normally got a team of people or boss or everything else. So that accountability piece is very tricky.
Well, and I found accountability is kind of a big ass word that we often will resist, especially if you've got any kind of rebel tendencies in you. which I don't know, Cassie, that may or may not be you. but a little bit. But I think, you know, turning it into, oh, like, can I play with this? Can I explore this? Sometimes even, like, for me, what I'm learning to fall in love with is self-responsibility, right? Like, there's some things that I've started experimenting with, you know, about 6 months ago, particularly around my body, that I've always had protective beliefs around, and I've really been efforting on the more helpful beliefs and changing actions, and that is now helping me feel so much more responsible for my health and my fitness and my weight and all kinds of things. So it's the actions haven't actually changed that much in 30-odd, 40-odd years, but my beliefs are significantly different. And that's what's changing, you know, the ease with which I'm able to do that. So yeah, anchor.
I love what you say around procrastination, Cathy. I often feel like I'm usually a very disciplined person who can get a lot of stuff done, but I've noticed that at times I'm like taking like, I don't know, 1 to 3 hours of something that you could call procrastination before I go to the next thing I really want to get done. And I was fighting myself around it for maybe 1.5 years now until I thought like, you know, the fighting doesn't help. Let me look what I'm actually doing if I let myself do what I call procrastination. And when I really watched myself, what I was doing and not judge myself, I noticed I actually really needed a break. I needed something else before I was ready to work again. Like, because I was maybe like you, I was always so used to do it the way I have been in a structure before that made me do more than I actually could do, because other people had ideas what I was supposed to do within my job or within my time or whatever, that I was still doing it to myself instead of actually asking myself, so what do I need right now in order to feel ready to do what I am actually want to be accountable for. And as soon as I then allowed myself, okay, so before, like in my case, it's two jobs, one job in the morning, one job in the afternoon. Even if I come home at 10, I allow myself 3 hours of break. And it's, I can totally choose what I want to do, absolutely free. And then I have another 4 hours of work. And then I feel ready. Because I don't demand of myself that I just keep going and going and going and going, like a rat race situation job would be.
Love it. And so notice, right, that procrastination is a resistance, a form of resistance. We're resisting the discomfort that something's come up. Something is saying, I don't want to do this. I don't feel safe to do this. I don't want to do this. It feels risky to me. So if you have that with clients, it's like, what is that procrastinating? What is your procrastination protecting you from? Is a great question to ask. What do you think will happen if you stop procrastinating? And then what you've done, Anka, is, you know, that sophisticated piece of saying, okay, what actually do I need right now? Because the procrastination will be hiding that, because it's just about, you know, comforting ourselves in some way. Yeah, Jane.
I took your hand out and I wrote a sort of just off the top of my head list of protective beliefs, and then had a go at thinking about small actions, experiments. One or two of them translated really nicely, and I could. So one of them was, it's not safe to be visible, like, yeah, in my work. So I thought, oh, well, yeah, okay. So I could post on Instagram and see what happens, how it feels, if it feels good, if it doesn't feel good. I could have a monthly newsletter and dare to use the word I a little bit more often. And so that one, I kind of went, oh, yeah, I'm curious to see. And that translated. But some of them didn't. And I'm just wondering whether now, looking at this in the light of our conversation, whether it, the ones where I can't think of experiments, it's probably because the protector's still got a tight grip. So one of them was, it's dangerous to dream big. And then I just thought, what can I, nothing. I can't just have an experiment to dream big. That's ridiculous. But now I'm just wondering, if I ask the question, you know, how would you like to feel? How would you like to, yeah, how would you like to dream? I don't know. If I just broke it down a bit or made it safer, maybe I could come up with ideas.
Well, yes. And I'm also reminded of what you shared earlier about your dog walk.
Mm.
Right? That actually, when it's full of ease and safety for you and there's no like big kind of expectation,
yeah, right,
it's actually really safe for you to have a little daydream.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's interesting because when I did the exercise on paper, I was like, well, it won't translate, so the belief must be wrong. I haven't got the right protective belief. It's too vague or it's too grand, or if I find the right protective belief, I can translate it into experiments. Yes. Whereas now I'm going, oh, okay, it is the right protective belief. It's got quite a hold.
Yeah. And also notice, right, that word big, it's not safe for me to dream. I can't just dream big, right? So maybe have the smallest daydreams possible for a couple of weeks. See how that feels.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help you, Jay?
Yeah.
Daydreamy dog walks. Perfect.
Yeah. Thank you.
Anchor.
Just to this dreaming thing, I and myself have noticed if I have a dream, there is another part in me that thinks I have to do it now. It's kind of like a rigid teacher that's like, okay, you want to do this, so why are you not? You're so bad and you're not following up on it. And if I just allow myself to have a dream to play with, and I'm like, that's interesting, I don't have to do it, but I can just play in my mind with it for as long as I want. And if at some point it wants to become reality, I may try some little steps, but it's still like the dream story does not have anything to do with what I'm asking of myself. So that gave me the freedom to feel like, well, that's just dream.
Yeah. You're reminding me of a therapist I saw in my 20s. I think it was my first experience of therapy, when I just genuinely thought, I have no idea what to do with my life. I don't even know what was the point of, you know, this 5 years of study and what have you. One of those quarter life crisis experiences. And my therapist, the one thing I remember from that experience, she said to me, I want you to just daydream about what you'd like to do. And she was like, make it a real fantasy. And I still do this. Like, I remember the last time I did this, I was walking through the Barbican in London, which is this brutalist 60s building. And I was thinking, oh, imagine if I lived here. And I had this, and I was like, I will play a cello in the orchestra and I will have lovers and I'll wear all black all the time. And I just had this real, like, quite vivid fantasy for, you know, like the hour or so that I was walking through this building and the gardens around it before a meeting. And it was just this really lovely experiment of, there are so many other lives we could live, and how lovely that freedom to dream is. And you don't have to do a damn thing. Like, honestly, no one wants to hear me play the cello. And you know, all of that, it can just be a fantasy. It can be super fun to do this with kids as well, and or with your partner. Imagine if we lived here, and then you see what unfolds. But the idea here is that it's about giving yourself permission to want what you want. And you start to see that, there is no kind of perfect life. There's no perfect belief. There's no perfect scenario or timeline where this all goes swimmingly, except in your fantasies. And that's a beautiful thing, right? I think that can be lovely. And then you can decide, what of that has meaning for me in this life, in this timeline where I'm at now? What do I want to take, if anything, from it? Or do I just want to say, that was a lovely half hour? Yeah. But giving yourself permission to want. Our clients often will have done that thing where they've followed the script. And then they get to a place in their life and they're like, shit, I was supposed to want all this. I've done everything I was supposed to do, and it doesn't have any juice for me. And often they will be telling themselves that that's because they did something wrong. And so giving them that permission to want what they want is a really great, it can be a really great gift and a doorway into what might be possible. So what I would like to invite you to do is is to take on an experiment for yourself, right? Maybe that's a belief that you've written down that you share with your client. Maybe it's about selling a velocity session and the experiment of doing that, right? Just seeing what happens. I'm going to see if anyone wants to buy this. It's safe for me to play. It's safe for me to offer this to people. Whatever that feels good to you. And just kind of take on an experiment that has meaning for you and notice some things. I've got a list of things that might be useful, right? Like what happens when you thicken that story through action, right? You give yourself some new evidence through your experiments. Notice resistance. Where and how do you opt out of the experiment? And like what new beliefs are created around your own self-concept, right? What's possible for you now once you start experimenting with this? It's a great thing to take on, you know, for our break, for our 2-week break. It's a great idea to play with this, and you can, you know, offer each other support in your pods and see what comes up. But take on something, take on one experiment, commit to at least one. I wouldn't have more than two on the go at the same time because that can be a little bit much. But give yourself some fun actions to play with. See what happens. Remember that the point of the experiment is to see how it feels before, during, and after you take action. So if there's something you know you're kind of holding back on, or you've got a protective belief that feels a bit locked in, do this process and just see what happens, right? The idea is we try something new to see what the result might be, see what will happen. True experiment. Does anyone know already what they're going to do? You want to play? Okay. Well, feel free to share in the discussion forum what your experiments end up being. I'd love to know. And also feel free to share any thoughts and ideas, resistances that come up, ask for support, all of that. Jane, you've unmuted. Do you want to ask something or say something? I'm just checking. You may not.
No. I was just laughing because I was beginning to have daydreams about taking lovers.
I think they're the best kind of daydreams. So fun.
Have still one question to what you shared before with the four quadrant.
Yeah, sure.
Like you explained the first. What are we doing with the other three?
Let me share my screen here. Oh, you mean this one here? Yeah. So the idea here is that you start to get a picture of how the belief shows up for your clients, right? So what emotions are they experiencing? And at the start, you can make some educated guesses, right? What are they doing or not doing, saying or not saying, either to themselves or other people, right? And remember, this is kind of what happens with the beliefs, emotions, and behaviors. This is sort of what happens in the belief buster. So the more you do that process, the more you'll add into this process. But the idea here is it's like, oh, if I believe it's not safe to share my ideas, the emotion I might feel is a bit sad or a bit unsatisfied. So if you want to sell a one-off session, I called them velocity sessions. If you wanted to sell a one-off session to a client, you could say, hey, if you're in your job and not sharing your ideas and it's leaving you feeling a bit sad and dissatisfied, I can help, right? Or, you know, or you could say, there's a one-off session. We can look at any protective belief. Here's some examples. And it might be leaving you feeling blah. So you're basically saying, I see you, dear client. I get you. I can help. Right? You've given it some thought. You've given it some ideas. And so this just helps you map that. Like, where are you meeting your client at? Does it help you, Anka? Yeah? Great. I'm so glad. So glad. Anyone else for any questions, comments, shares before we close for today? You're all good. I'm quite enjoying our intimate little morning class. It's fun. Okay. Well, have a lovely couple of weeks break. Please know I'll be checking the discussion forum every day. If you have anything you want some support on, just yell. Let us know when you sell your first one-off session. Excited to hear all about that, of course. But yeah, just please feel free to share anything that comes up for you, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks to start module 6. Yeah, Jane.
The break coincides beautifully with my holiday. But I'm just wondering, module 6 info, when will you put that up?
It actually comes out, I think it comes out tomorrow. I'll double check with Kay.
Okay.
But
it's just if it were to come out today, I could print it before I go.
Oh, but I can arrange that for you, Jane. Yeah,
okay. No, that would help. Brilliant. Okay. Thanks.
Cool. Right. Okay, everyone. Take care. I will see you in a few weeks. All right. Lovely to be with you. See you. Bye bye.